Okay. You ready? One, two, two, two. Hey, hey.
And for the record, this is the meeting of the ICANN board with the community groups, specifically ALAC, Sunday morning, 8:30.
Let me ask that you bring to an end the most important part of the meeting, the socialization with each other, and we get on with the required boring part. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judith. Ah. We begin the board begins a day long a day of interactions with multiple constituencies. For better or for worse, ALAC gets the board fresh in the morning. It's debatable as to whether or not the good news is that we're not yet tired out from all the other interactions, or the bad news is we haven't yet woken up. But in any case, the clock is moving forward, and we need to get started. So we have a set of topics. We shifted a while ago, a couple cycles ago, from having the boards send out our list of topics to everybody, which turned out to be more or less the same that we were sending to, same topics to each group. And it felt to me very much more important to be fundamentally in listening mode. And so these topics are, I think, uniformly ones that have been proposed from ALAC. Is that that's right, Olivia? There's a handout coming around with the topics, and they're on the board. Olivia and I have just had a quick consultation, and rather than going through in order, we'll mix it up a little bit. I see. There's one more added here at the... Okay. So we'll take the first topic, ALAC advice. How is it treated? Jump to the ALAC view is that unenforceable public interest commitments are useless. What's the board's view? And then we'll move into the others. The question that's posed here is, how is ALAC advice treated by the board? Is there a process in place for addressing ALAC advice as well as designated channels for implementation of our advice? So let me speak to that. Variants of this question have come up before, both in interactions with ALAC and interactions with others. To speak quite frankly, one version of the question is, why does the GAC get such a privileged position with respect to having its advice with a formal channel and a formal requirement that if its advice isn't followed, that there's a very strong requirement to consult and so forth? Here's my view, and I'll try to be pretty candid about where we are versus where we'd like to be. Where we have to be and where we fundamentally are, but always recognizing the difference between theory and practice, as it were, that advice from any of the advisory committees, and indeed advice from any of the supporting organizations, commands first-class attention from the board. No question, has to be that way. That is the fundamental relationship that we have to have in these matters. Now, that said, there's a couple of practical things that follow from that. The board is not an operating agency. The board is an oversight process, and even though the org chart clearly shows that the SOs and the ACs are connected into the board, what the board has to do with any advice is look at it, understand it, and then decide what has to be done with it, which almost always is in the form of rooting that advice to somebody, most often the staff, sometimes out to the other SOs or ACs. So, for example, when advice comes from SSAC, a process I'm moderately familiar with, the natural thing to do is to look at that advice and say, this belongs in the following place. And quite often, our preference is that the advice come with specific suggestions about implementation. So when I was working on the FSAC side of things, and in fact, I remember getting specific guidance from Peter when he was chair of the board, please give us advice that includes what we should do with it, so that if we say yes, the action is attached to it. We don't have, so that's the basic process. And moreover, the onus ought to be that when we get advice, in treating it seriously, if we don't accept the advice or we modify it in some fashion, we ought to have pretty good basis for doing that. We ought to not be casual or just dismissive. And at the very least, of course, we ought not lose it. We ought not just sort of have it go into a dark hole and never be seen again. So that's the mindset. Speaking again, quite frankly, we're not quite there. We don't have the mechanisms in place, and we're not being assiduous in tracking and processing. And I have it very high on my list that is going to be changed. And I'll say here, and whenever the issue comes up again, that we are going to have in place by the next meeting, by Buenos Aires, a formal tracking process for advice coming from any of the SOs and ACs. It will be comparable, perhaps a bit lighter weight, but comparable to the tracking that's in place for GAC advice, and that we will not only track it internally within the board, but we will make that tracking visible so that the fact that it has that it's on the list of things to be dealt with and what the disposition is will be visible. And in that process, if there's any anything lost in translation, we can sort that out. So that's one of the aspects of making it visible. But much more important, I don't think that will be so much of a problem as just things not getting attention, and we will force that to completion. That's my view, and I expect that be held to that. Happy to be on the record for that.
Thank you very much, Steve. Olivier Crépin-Leblanc speaking for the transcript. I think that you've been very very complete with this answer. Perhaps can we just have an action item, I guess, for an update next time we meet in Buenos Aires?
Yeah. There will be an update. The action item will be we will institute some version of a common sense lightweight tracking system, and one action item that we will do is send a short note to you and to all of the other ACs and SOs asking for some form of identification to make it easy to track, so that we're just and I'm not very hung up on what the mechanism is, as long as it's simple and straightforward, so that we can know which piece of advice we're talking about, and then just have a simple roster for keeping track of that and sending that out. And we'll put that in place so that it is up and running prior to Buenos Aires.
Thank you, Steve. We have Sébastien Bachelet and then Evan Leibovitch. So Sébastien, please.
Yeah, I wanted just to add that it's very important to have this process because, as you know, we'll lose a track of that within the board as the moment we lose the liaison from the ALAC to the board, because it's not the duty of a full elect board member to bring to the board what came from the at-large. Then it's important to do that without taking into account what are the type of interaction we have between the board and the organization. Whatever it's a liaison or it's a full voting board member, it must be independent of that. Thank you.
Did you want to go back to having a liaison instead of a voting position?
As Steve, you are asking me this question, I guess I can answer the question. It's that it was suggested that to keep the liaison when you had a board voting member, because it would have leave this liaison to the board interesting and open. But it was not the decision of the board at that time. Then we are in some dark place.
I like that answer.
Thank you. I see Ray and then Evan. Ray Pilzek.
Thank you. Of course, we could always just flip that seat back the other way and be done with it. It's easy. With regards to advice, if the ALAC is preparing advice, I think they need to look at the nature and content of the advice that they're preparing to send. If, in fact, it is advice for a policy that is under consideration, it probably would have been much more effective. In fact, it would have been much more effective if the ALAC had participated in the policy process of the SOs concerned and done it at a much sooner time, because this is a bottom-up process, not top-down. And when you attempt to effect a change in the policy process by going directly to the board, you are, in effect, wanting to have a top-down mechanism to fix something. And that's not right. The other thing to remember is that the higher up or the further down the process that you go to provide advice, the louder that it is you have to shout. When you do it at a earlier in the process, it is much easier for your ideas to be heard, assimilated, and put into the process. And if that starts working, then there's something else that needs to be fixed. But to be effective in the policy process, if it's really policy advice, that's where it needs to be. If it's advice upon a policy that's already there, then you need to consider the fact, well, maybe it is much better that instead of trying to go to the board to get them to do something about a policy that already exists.
So if I might, I like your point very much, Ray, and part of the evaluation of advice when it comes in, and I will take this on board personally, and as a board we should do it, that as part of our response will be perhaps gentle or perhaps more stringent sometimes, a response back to whomever is giving us the advice, whether it's ALAC or anybody else, that they could have done better by doing X, by getting involved earlier and so forth, and try to tune that process and provide learning.
I would like to finish. If it's something that you look at and is actually wanting to change something in policy, I would suggest it'd be much more effective if you went ahead and got into the right SO and started going, and then notify the board that you're doing this, so the board is aware that this is happening. And so that is another technique. And so I think you really have to look at what it is you're advising. And lastly, if it is, in fact, something that deals with an implementation, something that a procedure or whatever, then the proper person, in my opinion, is that you address those things to the executive, or because that's where the ball lies. And so bear those three things in mind, please. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray. We have a long queue already, and there was Evan, Alan, Holly, Bertrand. I'm a little concerned that we're just going to spend all the time on this subject, especially since I do believe that many ALAC and at-large members take part in GNSO working groups and in other working groups and CCNSO working groups as well. In an individual capacity, of course, but this still relate back over to the ALAC and to at large and discuss what's happening in those groups. So we do attack the problem at several levels. But first we've got Evan, then Alan, and then we'll see if anybody else wants to put their hand down rather than keep it up.
I'm going to respond to Ray's point and talk about something that ALAC has always wanted to try and see more of, and that is cross-community working groups. We still have a situation in which, for instance, in the policy versus implementation, we have an ALAC person, Holly, who's chair of it, but it's still a GNSO effort, a GNSO charter, and a GNSO approval. This is something, especially in issues like policy and implementation, that need to be community-wide. And I would really like the board to get involved in encouraging more CCWGs, something that has cross-community charters, cross-community approval. This is something I think would address the kind of stuff that Ray is talking about, not just for ALAC, but also for the other ACs, getting the GAC earlier involved in the process. This is something the board needs to take an initiative and pushing down and not just saying, well, nobody else is doing it, so we, the GNSO, are going to take policy and implementation on our own. It shouldn't happen that way. Stuff like that has to be cross-community. And very briefly to Sebastian's point about the liaison and so on, I think part of the impetus for that came out for the fact, and maybe this is historical, but I found very often that when the board made decisions on things coming from the ALAC, that they went through a filter. And by the time they got to the board, some of the points came out. The briefing, like the briefing notes you got, may not have actually matched our intent. And even something as simple as letting ALAC seeing the briefing notes on things that are of interest to us before you see it, so at least we can vet it and make sure that it's what we intended, could be the kind of thing that we're talking about. You know, in, rather than needing a liaison, just have a better and clearer idea of what we intended you to see. Thanks.
Let me just comment. The briefing notes come from the staff, and so I think I'm going to interpret your comment as being focused on whether or not that loop is being closed properly, which is a fair comment without pointing any fingers. But that's something that no reason for you not to be in the loop and see how that's being put together.
Thank you very much, Steve. I think that Evan was referring to the history, and historically, yes, that's been the case. We have seen a marked improvement on this, and also because I think there's been a lot of bilateral discussions. Board members have come to our members and asked and said, are you really meaning this? So they certainly communication has improved. Alan?
Thank you. My comments are with regard to what Ray said. The ALAC makes an awful lot of statements. We make relatively few to the board. The ALAC participates in the policy actions, whether they're formal PDPs or otherwise, of the rest of the organization, be it the CCNSO, the GTL, DNSO, or various ad hoc groups like IDN, more than any other part of ICANN. If we're making a statement to the board, it's not because we didn't participate in the process. It's because something has come up to the board, and we feel that within the board's discretion, it should be aware of our position in making the decision. The board is empowered to not accept policy advice if it's endangering the organization or the public interest or whatever. And those are the terms under which we generally give advice to the board. We have our problems like everyone else, and there may be exceptions to that, and we're certainly trying to fix it. But in general, we understand the process, and I don't think anyone can claim that we're not participating in the bottom-up development process as we should.
Thank you, Alan. Ray, you wish to respond?
Yes. If you recall, in what I said was, if you're not being heard, then that's something else is different. It needs to be fixed, because apparently, what the situation you described, if you're active participation, there's one or two things. A, the consensus determination is not being made in a proper manner. In other words, there isn't really true consensus. If, on the other hand, it's something other than that, then it's this wrong. You know, that you're right. If it's going to actually cause a fiduciary concern, a liability concern, those are things that the board's concerned about. And so, yes, the do no harm thing applies. But if that got through that way, and the fact that it had been raised during the discussions that you're describing, then it says there's something wrong inside that process that needs to be looked at and fixed. And certainly the route that you take to send an alerting message that says, hey, board, before you do this, you've got to be aware it's going to cause this fiduciary harm to your organization. It's going to put you at this liability risk is certainly something that you must do.
Thank you very much, Ray, and I'm a bit concerned of the time ticking. There is one thing which I need to let you know about, which is I have asked at-large staff to, since we are now in the era of metrics, to compile metrics on the number of hours that the at-large community, so their working groups, ALAC, etc., all of the conference calls, basically, that at-large is having, number of hours of conference calls between meetings, etc., plus also, and we're trying to do this, is to track the number of hours of conference calls that our members are having in other working groups. So we'll be tracking their presence, not just the fact that they are in a working group, but their actual presence on the calls. And it will give us a much better view of how much this community, at-large community, is involved not only in our little room, but also in all of the working groups across all of ICANN. Sherry?
Thank you. I don't want to add more to the process you suggested, but let's take a very practical example. Recently, you sent us an advice on the IDN variant and trademark, and we responded to you and we had meetings. I'd be very interested in your views as to what worked, what didn't work, because that's very practical and very recent. Could you elaborate or something?
Yes, thank you very much, Sherry. No, I think that on very tricky issues, issues which have a huge dimensional complexity to them, going back and forth in writing doesn't help because there's misunderstanding. People read more between the lines than the actual lines themselves, and when you deal with a complex technical issue, it's even worse because not everyone understands the same word the same way. So as a result, and I'm very grateful of this, yesterday we did have a face-to-face. There was a board IDN working group, and there was also the ALAC IDN working group met together informally to try and explain what our positions were and to try and find a solution or at least take away all the wrong solutions from the table. And that was very helpful. So I would hope that in future meetings, if there are some issues which have been going back and forth between the board, the ALAC, and perhaps even the rest of the community, we can meet in a small group and try and push the thing forward a little bit, at least to try and iron out the misunderstandings that we have in our statements, in which I do say are not perfect. You know, there are sometimes some words which are chosen and which are interpreted in the wrong way, and then we just go totally on the wrong track. So face-to-face was really helpful.
Thank you. We have this choice about how deep to go into this versus allocation of time for other topics. This was intended to be the short, easy one to get us going. Let's turn our attention to the fourth one on the list. The ALAC is of the view that unenforceable public interest commitments, PICs, are useless. What is the board's view? Well, the board agrees that unenforceable ones are useless. So moving on.
Steve, I was going to suggest that Alan expands a little bit on explaining our point of view rather than just using the unfortunate word useless, which some of us might think as being a good thing.
This issue came up at the last board ALAC meeting, and I'm not going to go over it at the same length. There was a snippet of information on a slide that compliance posted implying that something may have changed in the world is not quite what was announced in the PICDRP announcement, and that's good, but it wasn't really enough information. Our real concern is that if it's a public interest commitment, there be a way to enforce it. And although I hate to bring a slightly controversial issue into it as comparison, I will anyway. Under the current world, and I know it's changing, if we find Mickey Mouse as the registrant of a domain, we have a path to file a complaint with ICANN, and ICANN will start taking action through the registrar to fix that. Under what has been described publicly so far under the PIC, if we find that someone who is a licensee of ICANN, to use Fatty's new word, for a TLD is not meeting their commitments in some substantive way, we have no option. There is no path to notify ICANN. If we are personally harmed, we could put a bunch of money in it and file a DRP. I understand maybe that's not how the world is, how you envision it right now, but that's the last public announcement we have on it. We really need a set of processes to indicate that the DRPs are something that is useful, all the more so since the board is now proposing compulsory DRPs to address some of the GAC safeguards. Thank you. Compulsory PICs, rather, to address some of the safeguards. So we believe there's changes. We don't know what they are. We'd really like to hear exactly what they are from somebody so that we can have a level of confidence that the PICs have some meaning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Chris Despain.
So words are really important, and in the same way that useless has a meaning, so does enforceable. And I'm not actually clear what you mean. I think what you mean is it's not enforceable in a way that you like or suits you, rather than it's not enforceable. The PICs are enforceable because they're contractual, and therefore they're enforceable. So I'm unclear. I think what you're saying is you want some mechanism in place so that you – well, then I don't understand what you mean by unenforceable, because they categorically are enforceable.
In the only discussions we've had where people can have come out and say anything definitive or a document is there's the DRP, which to have standing you have to be you have to show you have been materially harmed personally.
So you are talking about enforceability in a particular sense.
Well, we're saying someone cannot point it out, and to date we have not seen, we've not heard that there's a process that within ICANN will attempt to enforce the PIC. We've been told that ICANN will enforce the decision of the dispute process, but not at a level before that.
Let me ask a clarifying question. I don't know personally what the state of play is with respect to the implementation and enforcement of the PIC. This is a factual question about where we stand in the process. Fadi?
So just very quickly, indeed, the PICs are enforceable. They are in the contract. What you're asking is the path to enforceability easy, difficult, accommodating someone or another one? That's a different question. So if the question what is the process, I will publish it. We will actually publish it again. It's published. It's on our website, but we will publish it in simple. Maybe we'll create a graph that basically clarifies what people can do, how they can go about it, what is the process, what is the response, who does it go to. I will publish that. I commit to do that. Then after that, I am sure there will be comments as to whether we like the process, or is it better or can be made easier, can be made cheaper, can be made faster. And I'm happy to hear these comments as well once we publish it. So we don't take more time this morning. I want to just reiterate, I don't think you meant that, but I want to clarify. These are enforceable commitments contractually, and I can stop a licensee from operating if they have violated these PICs. I can, and I will. Now, the process to get there, I will clarify. We will republish in clear terms very shortly after this meeting.
If I might, let me intercede. I think there are two key things here. One is to gather some data about how the process works. So that means going forward, getting some worked examples and so forth, and coming back and reviewing that. And the second is whether or not everybody has the same shared picture, same shared model of what the criteria is. We could well wind up in a situation in which one set of people said it's working fine, we've had these disputes and they've been resolved this way, and a different set of people could say, no, we're very unhappy with the whole process because it didn't come out the way we want, or didn't have access to various things, or we don't have the same picture of what constitutes not operating in the public interest. Both of those, whether or not the mechanisms are working properly, and the second is whether or not we agree on sort of the terms of reference of the whole thing, are important topics. We can only do a certain amount up front, and we should come back, even under the most ideal circumstances, come back in a year and take a look at the data on the table and really have a very focused attention on that.
Thank you very much, Steve. And we do have a queue here, so I do ask, I think I'll close the queue. Okay, I did have Holly in there as well. So we still have Erica, Sala, Evan, and Holly. But I'd like you all to keep your comments short, please, if that's possible. Erica Mann?
It's very easy possible, because I think, like always, most has already said. Maybe just to reiterate three points very quickly. I think Steve is right. We need to take the chance when we have a review coming up, or we can even, you know, force a review a little bit earlier on this topic so that we understand what is working well, is there disappointment with an ALEC, and if there is one, how can we fine-tune the process? The second, I think it is extremely important to wait for the way Fadi explained that the process will be published, and then to receive your feedback back, because this will give us some early indication about where you think that things are going, maybe not in the right way of your expectations. And the last point would be something which I am always very keen on. This is to combine the review with a careful evaluation process. And evaluation is still something different than just doing a review. It can be part of it or not. And I just would think so we should do this. And we should start tracking the plus and minuses as early as possible. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Erica. Salaniyata Tamanika-Wemaro.
Thank you, Olivia. Salaniyata Tamanika-Wemaro for the transcripts. In relation to what's being currently discussed, I would focus on what's enforceable, and that would be whatever is within ICANN's remit. And noting that public interest, global public interest, is certainly encapsulated within the affirmation of commitments. Having said that, a very practical example would be one of the discrepancies I see in relation to this is within Form 990, where it was estimated that there are only 26 volunteers. Now, that's a direct contradiction to what Fadi had mentioned in his opening remarks, where there are thousands of volunteers. The second issue related to this would be, again, what was in Form 990, which is the geographical breakdown of how ICANN spends its money, 44,000 in Russia, 7 million in Africa, 1.19 million in Lebanon. Now, I'm not disputing the rationale behind how these monies or resources were distributed, but in relation to global public interest, there is a need for, and again, enforceability within what is within ICANN's remit, to certainly consider and discuss how parity can be addressed, and what are some of the considerations behind how these resources are allocated. And I'd certainly agree with Erica Mann and encourage the board to please maintain the very high standard. And the reality is ICANN is the leading pattern for multi-stakeholderism, and as such, it has to foster a certain level of stewardship and ensure that going forward we continue to improve and progress. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Point taken. Thank you very much, Sala. And I think you might wish to follow up, because this is somehow off topic, but we'll move to the next person in the queue, and that's Evan Lipovich. And very short comments, please.
Yes. And my interest right now is sort of having a takeaway from this particular point, and simply to alert the board and senior staff. ALEC has a very, very deep interest in the issue of the PICs, because it's not something that's conventional contractual compliance. Did they pay their fees? Did they have accurate whatever? There's errors of omission, there's errors of commission, there's errors of interpretation, there's all sorts of things. And issues of standing and that kind of thing are much, much more nuanced, I think, than are currently being done. And this is just a plea that as you're going through this, you know our role in the ecosystem. Please keep us in the loop as you're evolving this. Thanks.
Thank you, Evan. Holly Reich to close this subject.
Just to sort of pick up on what Evan said, this really is about, in terms of complaint handling and enforceability, it's really a legal question about third-party beneficiaries and about standing and so forth, which makes it very difficult for a person who may be misled but not necessarily affected. So, yes, things are enforceable, but there are some legal constraints on that. I think the way through, or the question I was originally going to ask, is the board did ask for metrics or how to measure the effectiveness of the new GTLD system in terms of the three categories of consumer trust, consumer choice, and competition. Somewhere in there was a measurement which I'm really looking forward to see. Do people, do the new GTLD registries, do what they're saying they're going to do? Now, one way around that is, yes, to allow complaints. I understand that's difficult, but it would be very helpful if the review that's been mentioned did pick up on the need for the metrics to understand whether, in fact, the new GTLDs are doing what they said they were going to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Holly, and that was actually on our list. The question that Holly's come up with was actually on our list, so you very much slid into it. Any response or... I don't see anyone for the time being. Judith?
The question is, how do we know that they will? We don't yet. We have even to begin PDT. We do not know yet. So the question of whether or not ICANN has the leadership to ensure that they live within the contractual obligation, the leadership is there. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. And Fadi Shadi?
Yeah, just to remind everyone of some facts. We had no PICs in the contracts a few months ago. We were all talking about, you know, making sure people pay and do the basic things. And I think we need to appreciate that through your input, through community feedback, we have now created something that didn't exist called the PICs. We voluntarily asked if people would volunteer to say what are their PICs. Everybody said no one will volunteer. Hundreds of applicants volunteered. Hundreds of applicants. We have over 500 applications with volunteered PICs. We put the PICs, we put the system of PICs. This is all new. Nobody's doing this on the planet. It's thanks to you that we have come up with a very sensible regime to actually put an applicant in the position of committing upfront to the public. There are very few businesses where this happens. Yeah, maybe Coca-Cola does it, but they do it just for other reasons. Here, we made them contractually responsible for these things. This is all good, and I think you're now pushing us to the next level of being good, which is right. How are you going to enforce these? How is this going to happen? And remember, you don't want to turn ICANN into some law enforcement agency that's running around the world checking that a TLD in Bolivia who said they will only deal with people in this particular quarter of the city is doing it. I mean, this is going to take us massive resources to do. It's impossible. So we are moving actually into a mode where we are crowdsourcing the detection of issues. We're asking you especially, I think this is, by the way, a role the at-large community could play better than anyone, to keep an eye, to help us keep an eye on the public commitments. Now, if you find things that won't work, and we will publish that process so you will see it, we are responsible to chase and enforce and contractually make sure this happens. But we need everyone to be equally responsible with us in detection of deviation from the public commitment. And by everyone, I mean all of us, the governments, everybody, anyone who is watching, and we will publish these PICs very clearly on the website so everyone will see them by applicant. But I want us to really pat ourselves on the back a little bit here. Not me, all of you, all of us, for doing something that has not been done. Nor, there is a reference point for us, for people in contractual agreements committing voluntarily to public interest. And now we have to learn together how to enforce that. And it won't be perfect, but I commit to involve you in making sure that this process works for you. I will do that, Alan, and Olivia, I commit to you, we will do that.
Thank you, Fadi. And to close this subject, Alan Greenberg, please.
I'll be very quick. Fadi, we are absolutely delighted with the existence of the PICs, and we understand the unusual process by which they came about and the fact that they have come about. And if we had some understanding of the process you talked about in your last few sentences, of whether it's crowdsourcing or something like that, we certainly weren't asking ICANN to go be the police force and investigate. If there was some indication in a document that I had seen, this item would not be on today's agenda. So maybe we're just operating in ignorance, or maybe you haven't gotten around to documenting it yet. We'd like to push that forward.
I think we're ready to move on to the next topic. Dotless domains, dotless TLDs. Do DNS security and stability concerns receive prioritized board attention? And then specifically under that, dotless TLDs. So to the generic question, do DNS security and stability-related concerns receive prioritized board attention? This is a damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of question, because we hold security and stability very high as one of our core principles. And considering my own history and background, I could hardly steer away from that. And on the other hand, the next question, which always one has to be ready for, is, so that means you don't pay attention to anything else, which is not true. We definitely treat these issues with high attention. Let me just focus on dotless TLDs for a minute. I've been watching the traffic on that, and it's been very heavy. My sense of things is that we have plenty of data and that it's time to make a decision and move past it. I'm actually more concerned that we're not giving attention to the next set of things that are queued up behind it. There's plenty of other things demanding attention. It's not a board decision per se, but it is a next a new GTLD program committee decision, I believe. Shireen?
In fact, it's on the agenda for our next new GTLD committee meeting in early August, and we were just waiting for a report that we commissioned that's coming out, and that will be, it is on the agenda.
Thank you, Shireen. Yeah, if I can just add to this, the very fact that the board did ask for these additional reports regarding dotless TLDs, regarding also the certificate clash, and also the clash that might happen when an intranet top-level domain or internal domain might clash with a new top-level domain being created. That sent the message to the community that the board wasn't quite sure if the message was clear enough. We are particularly concerned about the stability and security of the domain name system and the user experience when those new GTLDs will be launched. So we need to make sure that this is entirely clear in the minds of board members. Any grain of sand in the works might have very large consequences, and obviously we urge caution. So I'm glad that this is on the agenda, and I do hope that the message that you have sent there is not your frame of mind at the moment. You should have by now a pretty good idea of which way to go. I see Thomas Norton behind you.
Yeah, thanks. Just a couple points. One of them is by raising this question or putting it on the agenda the way you do, you know, another way of reading the question is there's a feeling that we actually don't take security and stability concerns seriously enough. And I'd like to sort of probe a little bit deeper. Is there a concern that we are not doing so? Are we not acting quickly enough? Are we doing the wrong thing?
Thank you, Thomas. Actually, it stems from perhaps not that you're not doing enough, but from a question which has come up after the report on dotless TLDs. There was some clear statement by Microsoft, clear statement by Mozilla Foundation, by the IETF, by those people who I guess have got a very long history of knowing what the problem is with dotless TLDs and have given very clear advice for a very long time. Yet the staff report, which summarized all of the responses from the public comment period, said that there was no consensus and that there were varying views and therefore more work needed to be done on this. This was rather surprising for our community.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. So the other question I was going to say, just a point to make here, is under do DNS security and stability-related concerns receive prioritized board attention? And then you say IDN label generation rules for the root zone and don't say whether what the issue there is exactly. But I will just observe that the entire process we put in place over the last couple of years that led to the LGR process and the, you know, the call for panels and the integration panels is all about security and stability. That's why we're doing it that way. And I will say that from my perspective, sometimes it seems like we're getting sort of mixed messages from the community where there's a desire to move forward with IDNs quickly, and there have been calls for coming up with an interim solution or moving faster, when that is in some sense at odds with the notion of doing it in a stable, secure manner, because we have set up this process precisely to make sure it's done correctly. And at least from my perspective, it is moving as fast as it can. And if we knew how to make it go faster, we would be doing that. And so, you know, when we get the message, we still need to move faster, it's a little bit of a mixed message. You know, do you want us to move faster and take some interim steps, or do you want us to do this in a, you know, safe, in a safe and stable and secure manner?
Perhaps it's a case of wanting the cake and the money from the cake.
Right.
It's a two-pronged approach.
You know, as we say, I'd like a pony, too.
Evan, did you want to say something on this?
Just very briefly, and that when it goes back to your question, Thomas, of, you know, the way the question is phrased you know, does it mean that there's the concerns seem to come out when we were meeting with the ESSAC yesterday? There was a little bit of a sense of frustration that was coming out, and almost a thank you to us for having tried to enforce the issue further. And occasionally, you know, in the comments that came out to us, there was a kind of, well, we don't want to go into "I told you so" mode, and it was just this kind of sense, I think, that has sort of brought this out. Especially the dotless domain things brought it to the forefront, because here was an issue where we thought there was consensus, and then all of a sudden the board is acting as if it has to be restudied, and so this is just what seemed to be the frustrating part of that.
Rinaldi Abdulrahim.
Thank you, Olivier. Rinaldi Abdulrahim for the transcripts. Thomas, we do want the process to go fast, but we are also concerned about the security and stability of the DNS. So, yes, we want both things. On the root LGR process, our concern is that we don't want certain parts of the process to be undermined by politicization, specifically the integration panel, the selection of that. The composition of that has to be beyond reproach. So that is the specific thing on the LGR. I'm just saying this. We don't have to discuss it, but I'm just raising it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rinalia. And I do remind us that we did have a face-to-face with the IDN board working group. So I hope we're not going to launch into IDNs in a big way again. Edmund wanted to say a couple of words. Edmund, you have 30 seconds.
It's a very short comment. I think what Thomas brought up is very important, and that's from our point of view, I don't think we're sending mixed messages. It's a very coherent message. There was probably some misunderstanding between the two, and I think the process we started last night was very good, and you know, as we go forward, and this need to be one of the items to be talked about.
Thank you very much, Edmund, and I guess we can go to the last question, which means we might be in time. Steve?
The last question in this revised order is the one that's listed third. Expert working groups, who are they accountable to? Are they led by the board or staff? What purpose do they serve in a bottom-up organization? So this is, I presume, triggered first and foremost by the creation of the Expert Working Group on Next Generation Directory Services, although there are probably other instances that come up. Well, the board, let me speak for a minute about the genesis of a fair amount in just a minute. There is a phenomenon, a thoughtful work, bottoms up.
That's complex issues that solve issues down. Because our community has also become very siloed. A young your community, because your community does not allow us to sometimes. So we need to keep them open. We need to allow the world to participate in these panels, including our community. And it will be open. It will be transparent. Their meetings will be transparent. Everything we will do in these panels will be transparent. That I promise you.
In the spirit of a kind of a spirited dialogue here, I think there are some, not me, but there are some who would argue that closed groups of any kind should be prohibited. There shouldn't be no such thing as a panel of selected people in the cases going forward, or an expert working group in the case next year, that all of the meetings should be open. Anybody should be allowed to join. That should be our hallmark. And I think that is perhaps the essence of the criticism here that's being...
Okay. So that means the IETF working groups model is closed and unopen. Because that's what they do. A working group.
The IETF working groups are open. Anybody can join.
Anybody can join and give input to these expert panels, but
The existence of the panel, the idea that there is a panel of a fixed set of people, is I think the core of the objection. That's not a mechanism that is consistent with our rhetoric about openness.
Fine. I'm prepared to scrap the panels tomorrow.
I actually am.
If we believe as a community
formal direction
that
from
we
the
could
board
have an open meeting
that.
Like this to decide how the iSTAR community will cooperate, yeah. I'm prepared to do it.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Steve. And just for the record, the very existence of the question doesn't mean we disapprove of them. It's a case of we do have actually several of our members are members of the expert working groups, and from the feedback that I do get is that there is progress being made. So the question here is an open question as to who are they led by the board or the staff and so on. And it looks to me as though this is a touchy subject, but I hope we haven't opened Pandora's box. I see half the board members putting their hands up. But the first one who has put his hands up before Shireen put both of his was Thomas Norton, Erica Mann, Sébastien Bachelet, and I see Chris Despain, and Bertrand. Sorry, Bertrand. And that will probably take us to midnight if we have everyone speaking. So try and be short, please. Thomas Norton.
Yeah, thanks, Olivier. So on the topic of bottom-up, this is something that this question has come up many times, and I've seen it. Just a few observations here. First of all, it's not black and white.
Yes.
And when people try to make it a black and white argument, we don't get anywhere. I agree actually quite a lot with what Fadi was saying about horizontal. And yes. I have seen this in other communities. I've seen this in the IETF. I've seen it in the RIR community where you often have these conversations about, well, it's top-down, that's not allowed, it's got to be bottom-up. Bottom-up means, in an organization like ICANN, in a bottom-up model, the participants that do good work, what happens to them? They become leaders. They become part of the top. Does that mean they're no longer allowed to lead and be active? I think the answer to that is clearly that's not a good thing. The key in what I'll call a bottom-up organization is that the work is reviewed and the community is able to provide input and the community feels like it is listened to and the final result that's produced has the buy-in of the community. Okay, that's the key thing. The final output is supported by the community. And, the reality is, in the real world, work does not get done by a committee of 50 people. That's why you have to have design teams, review teams. You call them what you want, but it's a small set of people that can get together and work together, put out a straw man, and then the straw man gets iterated on and so forth. So again, the key metric is, and sort of one of the key metrics is do people that are not on this committee feel like they have to be on the committee in order to provide input and be heard? And if that's what's going on, you have a problem. The goal is that it's okay that there's a committee and I'm not on it because I will see the drafts, I will be able to review it, and if I raise valid input, it's going to be addressed. And if people feel that's happening, you got a good system going.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And I guess there will be applause recorded on the transcript as well. I hope there will. Next, we have Erica Mann, and we are running out of time, so let's make this short comments, please. Erica?
And to add to what Thomas said, I think one can take it even a step further. When it comes back to the community, comments are received. And there are issues which are really debatable. I think it would be good to really get these cross-functioning, discussions going on, because it's not only just one group then which will, want to reflect on it, because it will be more than, there are different groups from the community who want to say something. And this, I think, would be a good timing then to come together, discuss it, and then it can either go back or it goes directly to you, and then you come back with another report or whatever, however you want to shape it then.
Thank you, Erica. Next is Sébastien Bachelet.
Yeah, I think we are discussing more about the process than the result, and I know that part of the board member will disagree and maybe the member of this working group, but my concern is that I saw yesterday that they spent time to explain what they think, and they are defending the solution and not taking too much input from the community as an input. We are not yet on a final document. We are, and I hope you are here to get inputs. And I also think that such a group must come not with, we have the solution, we have the king of the world, we have found the solution. It struck me that we are already in one document, and you agree or you disagree, and we will spend time on that. It's not yet this time, and I feel that we need to find the right path and the right time to do each step, and we are too early in doing a final document to say it's the solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Sébastien. Two more people in the queue, and we need to close after this. Chris de Spain and Bertrand de la Chapelle. Chris, you're first.
Thank you. I was just simply going to forget Shireen. He doesn't need to speak. I was just simply going to talk about very briefly about a process point, which is that your question here, one of the things that surprised me about it was that actually at least a part of the question can be answered by your own people. Carlton's actually on the current expert working group and is perfectly capable of telling you that the staff and the board don't run it. So, I was slightly confused as to why that question was on in the paper. But I'm sorry, I feel like I just have to respond to Sébastien's comments. It is a gross mischaracterization of the process to suggest that the expert working group is not taking input, and to suggest that it has come with a final solution, and to suggest that we're not yet ready to start talking about these things. It simply isn't the case. The whole of this week has been about taking input. The expert working group, sadly without Steve or me in it for most of the time because we're doing other things, has been individually meeting with every constituency, every supporting organisation, had a public session yesterday all about taking input. So it really is incorrect to say that it's about us pushing a solution down people's throats. I know that's not the words that Sébastien used, but I just won't accept it being characterised that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Bertrand de la Chapelle.
It's valid that this question is on the table because it goes beyond this expert working group in particular. It's the general connection that was made before with the cross-community approach. And for me, the answer to the end of the question, what purpose do they serve in a bottom-up organization, is to focus on the issue framing stage. And in as much as I know that a lot of people joke about the tendency that I have to speak a lot, and it has become a running joke, I stick with it. Because in many cases, we don't talk enough about the problem that we try to solve before we actually address it. And we spend a lot of time, mistakenly, arguing about terms that we do not agree the meaning of. So the benefit of working groups, and I'll come to the question of how they're composed, which is a different one. The benefit of working groups like this is to very early on an issue, to get the different actors as representatively as possible to frame the issue in a way that is agreed and understood in the same way by everybody. And this, I believe, is saving months of work afterwards in terms of methodology. That's one. Second, I fully endorse what Thomas was saying regarding the notion of bottom-up being people feeling engaged and listened to. The key question that we have never circled, but that is a very difficult question in a multi-stakeholder process, is how do you compose legitimately a subgroup of a larger group? The methodology that we've used in the past, the task force in the GNSO, is to go constituency by constituency with delegates. That's a way. We move to working groups, but now we have no formula to compose this. The other possibility is to take a top-down decision from a pool of people who volunteer. My personal approach is, and there's no magic formula, is related to what Thomas was saying, like the certainty that when you have a position that you want to put forward to a group, there will be at least one person in that group that will faithfully convey it. That's all. You may trust somebody just for conveying this position. Not that he shares or she shares your views, but you need to have at least one person who will convey this position. And this means skewing the representation almost in the reverse to make sure that the ones that are less represented in terms of their access have at least one person in. There are no magic formulas, but that's one of the approaches. And the question of forming subgroups is a core of the future of the multi-stakeholder model.
Thank you, Bertrand. Okay, theoretically, we should be closing this because we do have an ATRT2 meeting that's just happening now. But with two more board members who haven't spoken yet, well, one who has put both of his hands up, which is very good, Shireen Chalabi, and then Olga.
I respect everyone. I don't really understand everything Bertrand said, but I agree with him. And I agree with Chris, I agree with Thomas. So silence is golden, and I'm not going to say anything.
Audrey Madruga-Forty.
Yes, hi. I'm not going to repeat all of the assurances that you have been given regarding the role of an expert group, only to say that an expert group of either drafters, analyzers, or those are workers. Those are worker bees to help get through a process that involves a lot of possibilities and a lot of information. And I think you should really see it as that, as a group that's there to aid and not supplant. That said, with that assurance given, and I see a lot of affirmative nodding, I think it might be helpful for you to consider cementing that assurance, creating among your own work a confirmation of that, an output of this discussion, maybe not necessarily a piece of advice, but a confirmation of that role. And that is likely to be helpful not only to your own group, but that others that may share this question.
Thank you for this suggestion, Olga. And finally, closing off, Thomas.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. I want to change the topic just a little bit and say, as many of you know, this is actually my last ICANN meeting here as a board member. I've done this for 8 years, and I'm pleased, of course, that we have a very capable and able replacement for me in Yanni over there. But what I just want to say is I've seen actually a number of versions of ALAC over the years. And quite frankly, when I started, ALAC was viewed as incompetent and irrelevant. I mean, there was a lot of issues there. And they're just there for the show, so ICANN can say we have an ALAC, but it doesn't really matter what they do or if they do anything useful. That's not true today, and I don't think anybody can say that. ALAC has made tremendous progress over the last 8 years, and I'm thrilled, really, to see all the work that's going on. In terms of the integration of ALAC with other parts of the community, that wasn't the case early on. The fact that you're actually issuing statements and statements that are, in general, pretty solid and good and useful input. I think it's just important to remember that ALAC is an important part of the ICANN community, because after all, this internet stuff we're doing, if it isn't working for the end user, something isn't right. And so you've got a very important role here, and I'm just really pleased to be able to say. To see where ALAC is today and have been a part of seeing it unfold. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And if I may say, we will be missing you on the board. But as you know, At Large is open, and there has been a precedent of board members joining the ALAC in Jean-Jacques Subrenat. So you already have a path all ready for you. So thank you.
Thank you, everybody. As usual, this is always a vigorous and spirited interaction and a good way to get started in the morning. Thank you.